This is the BBC World Service, and now it's time for the interview.
Hello and welcome. I'm Carrie Gracie. My guest today is a free man, but possibly not for long. The American government accuses him of the world's biggest ever military computer hacking after he penetrated computers belonging to the Army, the Navy, the Air Force and NASA in the aftermath of 9/11. The US Justice Department now wants to extradite him from the UK and have him tried and sentenced to 70 years in prison. So, is he a malicious and sophisticated cyber criminal or a bumbling computer nerd with very unfortunate timing? Gary McKinnon, welcome to the interview.
Hi there.
Which is it?
A bumbling computer nerd, yes, definitely. I never had any malicious intent or acted vandalistically. I despise website defacers, virus writers. I'm completely not in that category.
So how did the US government get the wrong end of the stick then?
I'm really not sure. In their terms, if you believe what they say, you would think I damaged every network I was on. But because of my intents and purposes, it was good for me to maintain a quiet presence on these systems. And they actually define the word damage in their sort of cyber terrorism laws to merely mean the rebuilding of the machine that's necessary once you realise that someone's gained unauthorised access.
I don't think they're claiming, are they, that you damaged every device that you went on. They're talking about $900,000 worth of damage.
If you read the indictment, yeah, they do claim that all 92 networks, I believe, I was on, they claim that it's damaged, merely because they have to rebuild them.
They've said it's the biggest military computer hack of all time, was it?
No, it's not. If you look at some of the viruses, like the Melissa virus, the Love something or other virus, that spread to military systems, commercial systems, and did far more damage than they allege I did.
Let's go back to the beginning then and sort out where you began, because you left school at 17.
Yep.
And started off as a hairdresser. How did you move from that to computer hacking?
Well, I got my first computer when I was 14 and taught myself a little bit of programming. And I was basically a hobbyist computer user for many, many years. And in 1991, someone said to me, oh, you should really try and get a qualification in this, since, you know, you obviously have a talent there. So I had to do an access course for mature students. And then I moved into contracting and would do short-term contracts working for banks and solicitors and that sort of thing.
And so how did that then turn into computer hacking?
When I realised that I could use my skills to do what I called research on those subjects which I thought were of great importance and which we weren't getting any real answers about from the government.
All right, well, let's talk about those issues then that you thought were of real importance. What was the first?
The very first thing was the UFO secrets. And it wasn't just having an interest in little green men and flying saucers. It's the sort of humanitarian aspect to it because...
Well, let's just start with the little green men and flying saucers. UFO, unidentified flying object, usually understood to be life from some other planet.
Well, no, actually, in the UFO community, it's very strictly understood as being an unidentified flying object. So the origin is completely open to question.
So it could be something man-made.
It could be.
Or could be some visitor from elsewhere.
Yeah.
But you believe in UFOs?
I believe that there are craft, or there have been craft flying around that the public doesn't know about.
And do you believe they're man-made?
I do, and I believe that their propulsion systems utilise anti-gravity, and that anti-gravity is such a huge leap that the technology was originally reverse-engineered from recovered extraterrestrial spacecraft.
Now, you're going to have to explain that in a bit more detail. So what you're saying is there was some spacecraft which visited Earth from another planet, or somewhere, and somebody had a look at it and thought, this is how to build a spacecraft of this nature and has built it. What kind of spacecraft?
A craft that operates on the anti-gravity principle.
What is the anti-gravity principle?
It's an electromagnetic process which allows you, you know, as Einstein said, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, so matter itself contains energy, matter is energy and energy is matter. And if you have a process whereby you can extract this energy from the vacuum, you have practically an inexhaustible amount of energy.
So when did you start having these theories or ideas?
Probably in the late 90s, I was reading lots of stuff about this. One great help was the Disclosure Project, a Washington lobby group run by Stephen Greer, who's a military doctor, very respected and a very long term of service. They published a book which had over 300 expert testimonials from people ranging from civilian air traffic controllers right up to, you know, five-star generals saying that there is this UFO technology, it is extraterrestrial in origin, and people are using it here. And for me, that was the real final swing, and it made me think, yeah, it's not just a nutty sphere of interest. It's a real thing, and it should be used globally, this technology, and not kept in the hands of a secretive few.
So you had a political agenda when you started hacking?
I'd say it was more of a humanist agenda.
Which was, this extraterrestrial technology, we should all have access to it.
Absolutely, especially if it's free energy, and we could solve famine, lots of irrigation problems. It would be a solution to a lot of human suffering.
So then you had some professional skills in terms of accessing computers, and you thought, hey, why don't I just have a look at the US Army computers, the Navy, the Air Force, NASA, Space Administration, Department of Defense?
Precisely, yeah. Straight from the horse's mouth, as it were.
And how did you go about doing that, then?
I did a lot of research on the web and found out that a lot of the military use Windows. And having realised this, I assumed that it'd probably be quite an easy hack if they haven't secured it properly. And it was even easier than I first thought. I downloaded lots of commercially available programs. And if you scan a large network, you find that eventually there's a few hundred machines with blank administrator-level passwords.
What's an administrator-level password?
An administrator is a user that has full control of the machine. It's not an ordinary user. So it's a very powerful account that can
be used. It seems astonishing that anyone at that level in any of these organisations, the American Army, Navy, Air Force and so on, that they would use those systems without effective passwords.
Yep, and also astonishing without firewalls as well, and without many of the common IT security barriers.
But they did.
But they did. Mm.
And you must have known that you were committing a crime.
I did, yeah, unauthorised access, I think, and modification of data, which you do merely by installing programs. I think it's about 3 or 4 years in British courts. But having looked at various other cases, I thought, well, I'm not damaging anything. I'm not a website defacer. I'm not a virus writer. So I may just get a few months community service.
So this is the view in the United Kingdom. It's viewed in a fairly relaxed way.
It is, yeah, because it's just unauthorised access. And nothing I did sort of modified the data or impaired the availability or integrity of data or the function of the machine.
Well, except that they said in the indictment that you effectively shut down a whole Washington regional military operation for a period.
Well, even me, having seen the lax security, I'm very hopeful that one person is not capable of shutting down the entire military district of Washington.
So you think you were doing them a service by pointing up their security lapses?
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't see it like that?
No, they don't. And when I was on there, there's basically a permanent tendency of foreign hackers on these networks. It's absolutely incredible. You can go onto a machine and see hundreds of connections.
So you weren't the only one. There were lots of people hacking it.
Yeah, and considering blank passwords are rife, and that's not surprising either.
How did you become aware of the other hackers who were penetrating the same military networks that you were?
When you're on a machine, you can type in a command called netstat, network status, and it lists every connection to and from the machine. And then you look up the IP addresses, the internet protocol address, and you find out that these connections are coming from countries all around the world. China, Korea, Turkey, Germany, the Netherlands.
And they couldn't be just military attachés in the embassies of those countries?
Certainly not, because a lot of the machines I was on were administrative machines that people go in and do a 9-to-5 job on, and they're logistics and support, and they're not sort of secretive or to do with any high-level political activity.
And did you work alone?
Yeah, I did, hence my name was Solo.
And did you have any financial objective?
No, not at all.
And did you pass the details on to anyone?
I occasionally showed friends the odd document and stuff, but, you know, it wasn't a conspiracy or passing anything on to a higher power. I didn't have a handler or anything like that.
Do you have a criminal record?
No. I think I had a minor traffic offence years ago, and that's it.
So going back to your humanist mission as you see it, did you achieve it? I mean, did you find the body of work on anti-gravity that you had hoped?
Not the anti-gravity, but the UFOs, yes. The Disclosure Project book, which I mentioned earlier, one of the testimonials was from a woman, I can't remember her name, she used to be a NASA photographic expert, And she said that in Building 8 of Johnson Space Center, they had a room where they basically airbrushed out. Apparently UFO activity is so incredibly common that they're very often airbrushing out images of UFOs from their higher resolution satellite imagery.
Why would they bother doing that?
Because a lot of these pictures get sold on to universities. They're already doing the work for other reasons. And following her testimony and looking for Building 8 on the network, which you do by various sort of IT means, even the folders had the same name. Like one was called Raw, one was called Processed. And the pictures were so huge, there was no way I could transfer the picture over to me and look at it. So I looked at it on the desktop of the machine I currently had control of. And I did see one image which I couldn't recognise as a normal sort of Earth-built satellite. It was cigar-shaped, had geodesic domes above, below, to the left and to the right, and had none of the normal sort of antennae and things we associate with normal satellites. But having looked at that picture on the desktop, I was then discovered by someone at NASA and actually saw, because I had graphical remote control, saw them move the mouse, right-click the LAN icon, choose disconnect, and that was me out of NASA.
And why would anyone want to airbrush out pictures of UFOs?
Because it's one of the best-kept secrets in the world. If the kind of information I found is on very secretive Navy websites, NASA websites, and private networks, and Pentagon private networks, well, I'm not even sure what their agenda might be, and why they'd be keeping it, and what they're even using it for. And this is what I was trying to find out. Why is this being kept a secret when it could be put to great use?
And did you discover any other evidence to back up your theory about UFOs and this conspiracy to conceal them?
Very circumstantial. I found Excel spreadsheets containing fleet-to-fleet and ship-to-ship transfers of materials and personnel. The heading at the top of the personnel sheets was non-terrestrial officers, a phrase which you can't find anywhere in any military documentation or anything on the web or any of their publications. These ships listed on the fleet-to-fleet and ship-to-ship transfers, none of the names matched US Navy ships or anything sort of common or known. So that, coupled with the photographs and the fact that the photographs were in the place that the expert testimony witness said they would be, led me to believe that, yeah, I was on to a good thing then.
So you're saying that somebody has got a fleet of spaceships that they're not telling us about?
Yeah, yep.
And that's somebody on planet Earth?
Yeah, and a completely non-Earth-based, in fact, to even have a new terminology for these officers, non-terrestrial officers. You know, they're not the Navy, they're not the Army, they're probably a mixture of Army, Navy, and NASA people, I would think.
Were you taking a lot of drugs at the time when you were doing all this?
No, I was smoking grass occasionally.
Cannabis?
Yeah, cannabis.
But you don't think it impaired your intellectual faculties?
It certainly did. I probably would have got a lot further a lot quicker if I hadn't have been. But it didn't make me imagine anything that wasn't there or see anything that wasn't there.
And did some of your friends sometimes say, Gary, you are imagining things that are not there?
No.
Do you have friends?
I do, yeah.
And did they know about what you were doing at the time?
They did, but not in any great detail. I mean, I would occasionally, as I said before, show them the other thing or tell them, you know, a funny story I'd read on one of the military sites. And they did all say to me, you really shouldn't be doing this. You know, okay, it's interesting and it's exciting and it's fun. But, yeah, I don't think they really grasped the idea of my entire agenda, you know, the whole thing about the humanitarian thing, of this free energy thing.
And did hacking become an addiction for you?
Certainly, and in fact recently there's certain books about computer addictions, and yeah, lots of that is very familiar. Yeah, you're sort of blinkered and blindfolded almost. I stopped washing at one point. I wasn't looking after myself, I wasn't eating properly, and sitting around the house in my dressing gown, you know, doing this all night. Even when friends came round, I'm still sitting there on the keyboard and stuff, and they'd go through to the front room and chat to my girlfriend at the time rather than me.
And your girlfriend, did she get fed up with this?
Absolutely, extremely. Mm.
So what did she do about it?
Dumped me.
And what about your job?
Yeah, I'd also left my job in October of 2000. That was one of the final straws in my relationship. She met someone else, and even though we were still living together, she was seeing someone else. That was very difficult for both of us.
You're still living together because you had nowhere to live because you had no job,
yeah.
And therefore no money.
Yeah, and she was being very supportive still, you know, probably too supportive.
That was nice of her, wasn't it?
It was extremely nice, yeah.
And you were using her aunt's computer to do all of this hacking?
No, my computer.
In her aunt's house?
Yeah, we rented out the ground floor of her aunt's house.
And after 9/11, the United States swept, of course, by a sense of vulnerability, huge effort to tighten up security on every front. President Bush talking day after day about a war on terror and the need for vigilance in every dimension of American life. Did it not occur to you that you should stop hacking into American government and military computers at that point?
It did, but again, in my opinion, I wasn't a malicious presence. And I'd been on those systems for over a year already.
You were a good guy.
So, yeah. Well, in my eyes, obviously not in theirs, because you shouldn't even be there. But I liken it to if I saw an aircraft hangar with lots of interesting secret aircraft designs, and then there was no guard on the door, and the door was wide open, I'd certainly walk in there as well.
And your lawyer says you're a pacifist. Were you hostile to the American invasion of Afghanistan or to the plans for conflict in Iraq?
I certainly think it was the wrong thing to do, yeah.
But your hacking, was that an attempt to sabotage American military operations?
No, not at all.
And by late 2002, you describe yourself as having become sloppy and indeed megalomaniac, as you put it. What does that involve?
Sloppy means rather than bouncing your connection around the world, you'll bounce yourself through one or two other computer systems before you get to your final destination. And I think I almost wanted to be caught, really, because it was ruining me. It already ruined my relationship, my career. I was thrown out of the house. And so I think, although I'd never believed this, I had that classic thing of wanting to be caught just to put an end to it, because I myself couldn't.
So you left traces of where you'd been, which is how they found you?
Yeah.
And what about the megalomaniac bit?
I think because it was so ridiculously easy, I lulled myself into a false sense of security.
You got delusions of power.
And thought I could just walk around anywhere and look at everyone's files and make copies of everything.
And left messages to those who you'd invaded.
Yeah, I started leaving diatribes about that. I thought 9/11 was a conspiracy because there are hundreds of unanswered questions about 9/11. And, yeah, I used to get into, you know, some of the most secure systems in the military and leave notes on the desktops of the system administrator's machines. And I did this many times, left many diatribes, but still there were bank passwords everywhere.
You're listening to The Interview in the BBC World Service with me, Carrie Gracie, and my guest today, computer hacker Gary McKinnon. Gary, describe your arrest.
I'd had 1 hour's sleep that night. I'd been playing computer games all evening. And then I was woken up by an officer of the National High-Tech Crime Unit.
This is a British officer. You were in London?
Yep, in London, yeah. And I was very sleepy and a bit kind of dreamy. I wasn't even sure what was happening at first. And so they were there to arrest me. It was 8:30 in the morning. Tam's in advance at the door because she was getting ready for work.
Right. This is your girlfriend or ex-girlfriend?
Yep. They put us in different rooms, searched us both, questioned us both, took us both to the police station. When we got to the police station, they threatened me with keeping Tamsin in even longer unless I opened up and started asking some questions. This was before a solicitor came. So then I decided to not wait for a solicitor and just to answer everything, because everything was on my hard drive anyway. So as far as I was concerned, I didn't need the expert advice at that time.
And how did you feel? Scared? Stupid?
Scared, stupid, really, really sleepy. So that was kind of dulling it slightly. I did get 3 or 4 hours sleep when I reached the police station, because I was in a cell for 3 or 4 hours before they questioned me.
And did you feel guilty? Did you feel misunderstood? At what point did it sink in that the crime that you had been committing for several years by this stage had been discovered?
Okay, I felt guilty because I was guilty of unauthorised access. I knew I shouldn't be on these systems. The UK police initially told me, oh, maybe just a few months community service, and I had 2 police interviews. And by the time of the second one, the UK police had already travelled to America and spoken with some very high-up brass from the Office of Naval Investigation and the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And I don't know if it's perhaps because we have quite a lot of Hollywood in our culture, but they seemed overly impressed with these guys and came back with a very, very different attitude. And that was when I started to get scared. But the real scary thing was in November of 2002 when the extradition threat came.
Because before that, you'd thought that you would just be tried in the UK and get off with this community sentence where you'd be, what, doing some gardening or
perhaps
painting?
Even, well, no, perhaps even 2.5 years or 3 years because of the unauthorised access and modification of data. Yeah, in prison, yeah.
And then when the Americans started talking about extradition, then you realised that you actually were potentially in for a serious prison sentence.
And that was terrifying. In fact, at that time, it was 80 years on paper.
And now it's 70 years on paper.
Yep.
7 charges, 10 years each.
Yep.
Would they not run concurrently, so you'd be out in 10?
I haven't had any indication of that. But they initially offered me a deal back in 2002, and it was no deal at all, a deal being something which two parties negotiate and arrive at an agreement about. And they said, no guarantees or promises, but if you walk over and don't force us to go through the extradition process, we may give you only 3 or 4 years inside, but with no right of appeal and no right of public comment, so a secret trial that I'm not allowed to speak about, and nothing in writing. So I said no, obviously.
And now you face extradition, and you've clearly angered those who are going to have to go through all the bureaucracy of getting you over there.
Hmm.
What would it be like to serve a prison sentence in an American prison?
Well, reading the last Amnesty report about American prisons, especially in Virginia, which is where I would be tried, it sounds absolutely awful. They routinely wear stun belts, and the guards have remote-controlled stun buttons, and if anyone's out of line, they press it and the guys get an electric shock. They're so bad that they go unconscious. And apparently there's great abuse of these systems.
And would anyone come to visit you in the States if you were in prison there? I mean, in Tamsin, is she long gone?
Oh, long gone, yeah, yeah. It would be very, very difficult. I mean, it's hugely expensive. So it's, obviously you could do that once or twice, maybe once a year or twice a year, you know.
And is there anyone who would want to come and visit you?
Yep, parents and a few close friends.
And are they angry with you? I mean, some of these friends who've been telling you that you shouldn't be doing you were doing,
yeah, very angry.
They're saying, we told you so?
Some are, yeah. Yeah, and a lot of them aren't. You know, you think, oh, I wish I'd listened, kind of thing.
And did you feel guilty about getting your girlfriend, her aunt, into trouble?
Terrible, absolutely awful, especially because the warrant they had was for the whole house, so they went up to my girlfriend's aunt's house and took her computer as well. And so, quite understandably, that was when her aunt threw me out of the house, and I'm in complete agreement with her.
And are you tense about your hearing next week?
Yes. Yes, very tense.
And what do you do with yourself now? I mean, this is now almost 3 years since this arrest, since the talk of extradition. The terms of your bail are that you can't go online. That must make life difficult.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to operate a computer connected to the internet. I'm not allowed to apply for any travel documentation, sign on at my local police station every evening, and stay at my own house every night. Not having the internet is a great inconvenience, because obviously I'd love to be emailing MPs, etc., etc., but luckily I've got such great friends and family that have been hugely supportive in doing all that for me. I can check my email, but it's, you know, via proxy, it's via another person.
But the main business of your life at the moment is Free Gary McKinnon.
Yeah, yeah, it's almost like a new job.
And if there were others doing the same thing as you, hacking into American military computers just as you were, why are they prosecuting you?
My opinion is, having spoken to a couple of investigative journalists who've actually been across to America and interviewed high-up DOD officials, I can't repeat anything specifically because it's going to come out soon, I was in places where I really shouldn't have been and where...
So you did have... because, of course, it's been said repeatedly that you didn't have access to classified information.
That's what they say. But according to some of these officials, I'll quote one verbatim, when asked... why do you want him tried over here at a secret trial? He said, there's no way we're having the stuff he's seen, the places he's been, dragged through the public arena.
And do you still take an interest in hacking?
No, not at all.
So the latest stories about Trojans, about worms, farming, fishing, all of those things, you just look the other way?
Yeah. I mean, also, it's very much for muchness. Nothing much changes in time. You've got a few various breeds of malicious software, or malware, as they call it, and you're just getting new versions all the time. And that's mainly kids and young teenagers who've picked up the old versions and slightly modified them. Hence, you get Melissa A, Melissa B.
And so those who are responsible for prosecuting you, do you see them as part of the original conspiracy?
No, not at all. They're just doing their job.
And other hackers have gone on to run their own computer security companies. Do you feel unlucky? Do you feel cursed that you're facing the prospect of potentially of spending a very great part of the rest of your life in an American prison?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, scapegoat, that word has been used already. Where you bear in mind there is or there was a permanent tenancy of foreign hackers on there. Them having found my tools, and I wrote my method down in detail and was going to publish it on the internet saying this is absolutely ridiculous. But I didn't in the end. Having discovered all these other presences that shouldn't have been there, I thought, well, no way, this is really, really dangerous, you know, because some of these systems are very important. So, yeah, I do feel unlucky, yeah, yeah. But I can also see why they feel they have to do this. I mean, it's probably going on a lot more than we know. There's probably lots of unreported attacks going on, probably very damaging attacks. And I think I'm a convenient scapegoat because I was so open and leaving the documentation and so prolific.
And do you regret what you did, or do you think that that humanist mission you started off by telling me about, that that was worth it?
I obviously regret what I did because my own personal situation is very, very bad at the moment. I also didn't want to cause any trouble. I'm sure there's quite a few innocent systems administrators in the military and where heads have rolled by now. And it's probably not their fault at all. The military should have specially trained personnel. They shouldn't train up someone who's already part of the Army or the Navy and just give them, you know, a short course on computer security or whatever. Yeah, I do feel guilty and regretful.
And these systems out there, the ones that you hacked into, your conclusion seems to be that they're as vulnerable as ever.
I think so, judging by the recent General Accounting Office report. Yeah, it's still going on. And in fact, there's a huge swathe of recent military attacks. I think 3 months ago it was in the news.
Attacks on military computers.
Yep. So it is still going on.
Gary McKinnon, thank you for joining us on the interview.
Thank you.
Kerry Gracie was talking to Gary McKinnon. The programme was produced by Ed Butler. We'd love to hear your views on the programme, so why not send us an email to the interview, that's all one word, at bbc.co.uk. And you can access the programme on its own website at bbcworldservice.com and choose the interview from the drop-down programme menu.